Greetings, friends. It is I, Professor D. Trussell. I'm a professor at Harvard, one of the great universities, an Ivy League university. I am tenured. I study chemistry, which I consider to be the ultimate field of research. And my many years in chemistry led me to a magnificent metal known as mercury. And it was mercury that inspired me to start a podcast, even though many of my colleagues said that that was a mistake because I wouldn't be taken seriously by the medical journals if I started a podcast and interviewed whoever I wanted. But I am tenured and I wanted to do a podcast and I wanted to sing songs and I wanted to write an album and I wanted to work on a quantum entanglement style time travel device that is a wearable wristwatch. But most importantly, I wanted to sing. I wanted to sing about one of the great metals. Here's one of my songs from an upcoming album. Mercury, a mysterious metal that goes fast. They call it quicksilver. I like it in my glass. Drinking mercury before I go to class. Mercury's the answer. Mercury's the answer. Drinking mercury. That's actually a track from an album I'm releasing. It's called Mysterious Mercury, and it is obviously dedicated to a misunderstood metal known as mercury. Here's another song from the album. And here's just one last song. There's actually 700 songs on the album. So it is a digital download. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to fit it all on a CD, though I do have an idea for a CD made of mercury. I think it could be used to store not just data, but feelings. Here's another song from the album.
Beautiful liquid metal, silver like an angel. Let it dance inside you. Please don't be a stranger. Don't believe the stories that they tell you, that it's poison. It's life in metal. Life in metal. Life. We call it mercury.
We have an excellent episode for you today. With us here today is someone you probably know from The Midnight Gospel, a show I created with the genius Pendleton Ward a few years ago. David on The Midnight Gospel, David in the human realm. It's David Nickturn. He is my meditation teacher, my friend, and a wonderful person who has written lots of really great books. We talk about one of them on this episode today. It's called Awakening from the Daydream, and it is good. If you're interested, I will have a link to it at duncantrussell.com. We're going to jump right into this podcast. Some quick announcements. First, I would love for you to join my Patreon. You can find it at patreon.com/DTFH. Every week we get together, we meditate, we have a long rambling discussion. Your family wants you to come to them, your true family, not your blood family. Don't be tricked by them. They're robots. Come to your true family, the DTFH family. You can subscribe at patreon.com/DTFH. H. Also, my loves, I'm going on the road. I will be in Tacoma next week, if you're listening to this, on the week of the 16th. And then not long after that, I'm going to be at Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco, one of my favorite clubs ever. I hope you'll come out and see me. All the tickets, you can find them either on my website. I still got to get the ticket links up there. I'm lazy. I need help. Or you can just go to the Tacoma Comedy Club or Cobb's Comedy Club and grab tickets. They are going super fast, so I hope you'll get the tickets in advance. All right, let's jump into this podcast. I hope that you will come and hang out with David and I on Tuesday, September the 26th. We're going to be doing a free live online discussion called Eternity and Nowness. Very simple topics, but you know, why not start with the basics? If you want to sign up for a spot, you can find the link at duncantrussell.com. We're also going to be talking about the Dharma Moon Meditation Teacher Training that starts in October 2023. I've taken this because it's a great way to learn about Buddhism. What do they say? If you want to learn about something, the best way to learn about it is to drink mercury, to pour it all over your body, to cover yourself in it, and get it in your bathtub and your pores, every orifice filled. Or to teach, and if you don't have access to mercury or you're one of the people who think it's a very deadly neurotoxin, again, that's the Dharma Moon Meditation Teacher Training. It starts in October 2023. If you're interested in that, again, the link is going to be at duncantrussell.com. Or if you want to, you could just go straight to the tap by heading over to dharmamoon.com. That's dharmamoon.com. I'm a dad now. Don't drink mercury. I can't believe I broke the bit. I don't know who's listening to this. It's poison. I just watched a bunch of YouTube videos on it. It inspired whatever you just heard at the beginning. God, I've become soft. I don't want you to drink mercury. Please don't drink it. It's not good for you. At least that's what they tell you. All right, everybody, here we go. Let's dive into this wonderful conversation with someone that I've been working with for years now, who has truly helped my meditation practice and taught me so much about Buddhism. Everybody, welcome back to the Duncantrussell Family Hour podcast, David Nichtern. David, it's so great to see you. Welcome back to the DTFH. You are not in New York right now. You are in LA. What are you doing out there again?
That's a good question. I'm on my way to Joshua Tree tomorrow to play guitar with Krishna Das at Bhakti Fest,
okay,
which is the closest thing to a Grateful Dead concert I've been able to conjure up for about 40 years.
Wow.
Lots of tattoos, lots of yoga, lots of maybe some frisbees and lots of chanting and meditating and good food. So that's tomorrow through the weekend.
I've heard so many good things about that.
I put a couple of days on either side of it for visiting friends in LA.
Cool. Are you enjoying being in LA?
Well, it's an interesting question. Driving in, I thought, it may be declining. Possible.
Oh, really? Is it? I didn't notice.
It used to be such a kind of springtime energy place, and everything's blooming and blossoming and happening. And I think it's like I see signs of old age, sickness, and death everywhere. Maybe it's just my personal karma to be seeing that right now. But it feels like things are in a slightly decaying mode. Do you think so?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, that's why we left. It's sad. It's such a great city. Mm. It's such a beautiful, wonderful city. It used to be, and it just, you know, it's tough, man. Like you can't. I think the great like quandary is you want to be compassionate and you want to sort of have like there's it's America was is a story of failed utopias, you know, attempts at utopia.
Good topic for us today, actually.
Failed utopias. Yeah. So you know, so many people, the great American experiment, you know, look at the pilgrims, right? They were coming here. They were going to have some incredible, like, religious utopia. And then you look at all these other attempts at utopia, including the current attempt at utopia that is definitely not working out. And I think with on the West Coast, they're utopians. It's so beautiful out there. It's so beautiful. Why wouldn't you want to create a utopia out there? But how do you deal with the, you know, you have to figure out what compassion is, you know, and what it really looks like. And I feel like for them right now, they feel like there's some compassion involved in like letting people with traumatic brain injuries and fentanyl addictions and like big problems that should probably be dealt with medically, stay out on the streets, or maybe they can't find the funding, or they don't know what to do, or I don't know. But then what that creates this death spiral, which is you know you're dealing with like the hippie dream, right? Like, is no police. That's the hippie dream. No police, no heat, no pigs, right? It's the hippie dream. What a beautiful dream. But then what ends up happening is, if you stop, what side do you want to err on? Do you want to err on the side of like authoritarianism and like, no, we've got to have strong, strict, brutal regulation and laws, or do you want to err on the side of no, not much regulation, compassionate DA? You know, it's a mess, and so they're on the side of like, okay, they're trying to see what happens if they were loosen restrictions, and you get this. You know, mobs of people robbing stores, then the stores, they can't be there anymore, so they leave. The stores leave, people leave. Now you're not collecting as many taxes as you were to pay for whatever services you would need for the people out on the streets. And this is a death spiral. You know, you need taxes to fix the problem, I guess. So that's
well, I think more
my
than,
vibe.
Duncan, more than, a death more than a death spiral, it's an alternating waveform. Where you go towards, you know, one emphasis, and then you go towards the opposite side. It's the yin yang kind of spiral. Right. So, I mean, New York is like that. It's gone through phases of you know, where the city gets refurbished and uplifted, and then goes through periods of deterioration. I think that's just where we are, and it really has to do, from my point of view, as you know, having written the book on the six realms, you know, in the Buddhist paradigm. It's really about that and really suits that. So for me, L.A. used to be sort of a God realm. You know, things were kind of, you know, I remember going, I grew up in New York and going to somebody's house and they have avocados and lemons growing in their backyard that you could actually eat. It's almost, you know, prosaic and archetypical. So, but in terms of what we're doing with our personal journey, are we trying to get to the God realm? Or are we trying to get to a sort of more awakened kind of a pervasive state? Is a real, that's a probably a Buddhist question. Maybe people don't even know what we mean by that. But is there anything you could hold on to in any kind of idealized realm? Is there something that you could fixate on about it and make it sustainable? And that's the idea of the God realm. And none of the realms are permanent. So they say in the God realm, if you have that kind of great karma, at some point a little sweat develops in your armpit. And you start to have BO. You start to crash.
Stinky gods.
Well, it's unsustainable because there's too much fixation and attachment in it, and then the engine runs low on gas and it turns into its opposite inevitably.
Well, you know, also I would imagine like if we're going to talk about literal gods, like you would be, I imagine that like literal gods are sort of they're weirdly lacking situational awareness, right? Like they're the more you start experiencing a rarefied life, whether like God realm or hell realm, the less connected you are to sort of normal life, and the less normal life makes sense to you, and the less what normal people do makes sense to you, even if you That's want right. to imagine it does. I mean, there's at least a few videos of politicians going to the grocery store because they want to seem like they're of the people. And so they go to the grocery store and they have no fucking idea how to like buy groceries because they haven't bought groceries in years. They're always confused. They don't know what's going on. Like the normal day-to-day stuff that they're supposed to be hyper aware of so that they can legislate or whatever. They don't experience that. I can't remember. There was just a politician who was like bitching about some kind of like, I don't know, rich fish. I don't remember what it was, crudo or something, you know, like trying to connect with people, like kind of like saying like, the caviar has been, the price of caviar these days is fucked because of inflation. Yeah. And, you know, so that's God realm, right? Like I saw a
guy who looked just like Kim Jong-un in the Korean market here yesterday, but I don't think it was him.
Oh, no way. Maybe. You never know. I think he's in Russia right now. But so God realm, you on top of sort of like you sort of lose the thread and you I guess from the mythological perspective, living hundreds of thousands of years, infinite access to sense gratification, you would forget however you even started as a god or whatever it was before you were a god. And then you would sort
the flavor of that realm is ignorance. That's the that is the texture of that realm. So when they say ignorance is bliss, they're not kidding. You know, there's a sense of ignoring certain aspects of reality to sustain that kind of high. And that could be just a temporal level. You know, that could be a temporal level, or it could it could be if gods have their form god realms, and then there's formless god realms. Those are incredible. You're just completely, you don't really have a body. You just have a sense of space and bliss. But it's not sustainable.
Nice.
If there's any attachment to it, it's not sustainable. Otherwise, I'm there. Sign me up. Not compassionate. It's based on ignorance too. Ignoring.
Do you remember when Gal Gadot and a bunch of celebrities during like the pandemic had barely been going on, and they put that awful video out of them singing Imagine? Do you remember that? It was one of the most cringy, oh my God. It's all these like millionaires. And imagine all the people.
Yeah.
Like you could see the houses they're in. They're like, they've got pools behind them. They've got gardens, groves. And they're like in some like just impotent attempt to soothe the nerves of people who are like now in a 2-bedroom apartment with 3 kids. And they can't leave. They're singing John Lennon, and it's just so satanic and messed up. And so to me, that's the other thing about the God. When I think about the God realm, it's that even the attempts at connecting with the human realm are warped and diluted and twisted in this specific way, so that whatever they try to do that even seems that was meant to be compassionate comes off as a completely elitist and completely out of it.
Yeah.
The gods. God. Yeah, well, so you, and then the hell realm.
Wait, don't go to the hell realms. Go down to the jealous god realm, which is the adjacent one, which is, there's some access to what you're talking about, but it's not a given, and the space becomes very competitive and aggressive to achieving those things. It's not like falling off a log. It's you have to work for it, fight for it, and in that realm, there's no compassion. So that's because you can't have compassion for people and strive at that level. It involves putting some people down to get there. You know.
So this is Zuckerberg and Elon Musk like fighting online with each other and like saying that that their dicks were bigger, like literally like my dick is bigger than yours.
Like, did they actually,
you know,
say
these
that?
Are, yes, they were going to get in a boxing match. Like, here you have 2 billionaires and you know, if you're a billionaire, you could do anything, go anywhere you want, do anything.
Yeah.
But, And there's a lot of billionaires out there that don't tweet. That's the realm of the gods, billionaires. They're out there. Yeah. Who knows what they're doing? We don't know what they're doing. Who knows what they're doing? But then you get the tweeting billionaires. And Trump is another example. And that's how you know if you're a billionaire, if you're tweeting at another billionaire that your dick is bigger than them, you are no longer in the realm of the gods. You are now in the realm of the jealous gods, because surely there's something else to do than fight with other billionaires on this planet. Like, you could, just the pranks you could play as a billionaire, the trolling, the chaos you could sow just for fun. That's none of them make, like, if I were a billionaire, all I would do is make commercials for fake products. I would try to buy all the commercials in Fox News for weeks of just fake products, and just for fun, just for fun. They don't do that. They don't do that. They fight each other. It's so sad. It's such a waste of money.
Do you think any of those tweeting billionaires listen to you? Are they listening right now, maybe?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know. I doubt it. Like, if they do, Liz, please just let me. I will help you make the fake commercials. Like, we will have so much fun making fake commercials and fake UFO landings and just all kinds of joyful things we could do together. But yeah, I don't know if they do. I don't know. I mean, wouldn't you love, though? I mean, like, it is something like we can only sort of fantasize about what that incarnation is like. Wouldn't you love a day or a couple of days in that situation just to get a taste?
We've had incarnations like that. Most likely.
But I mean,
personally,
I would say
God realm and jealous God realm, there's something familiar about it. And, you can sort of see the bridge that leads to it. And maybe you've made decisions not to cross over. I mean, like, you could have tremendous success, don't you think? And that would put you in that kind of zone.
I mean, I don't know, like, the map for comedian in general. There are, like, you know, even the top of tier ones, I don't know if they hit billionaire level. I think to hit billionaire level, you got to get into, like, tech, or you got to get into real estate or something like that, you know? And I don't know if it, what the difference is experientially between $800,000. And I don't even know what is the definition of billionaire property owned, or is it, like, liquid, like cash in the bank? Like, I don't know. Or is that... I have no idea. But I mean, you see the billionaires, like Putin, that's a billionaire. Realm of the jealous gods. You know, he's in hell. He's existing in a, he's like somehow simultaneously a god, but he's living this.
He's not in hell because he's winning. He's not in the hell realm. If you jump down to the hell realm, you're a loser and you're not winning even one hand. You don't win one round. There's no up and down to it. It's just down, down, down. So
in a day,
I think most of us go through those realms. And by the way, not to, put too fine a point on it, but the book I wrote called Awakening from the Daydream that we've talked about before, it talks about
what we're
talking about right
now.
Well, and it's a good way to get oriented towards both the realms as a state of mind and also as a sort of manifested condition that you can enter in. So like in your situation, you have a new little baby girl, right?
Yes.
And you're all tenderized, right? You're all like gooey, right?
Yes.
And you see children in the park playing. You go like, oh, I want to help them. I want to be, look at how sweet that is. And you see their parents acting badly. And you say, I understand how that feels, right? They just have a bad day and they're out of patience. That's called the human realm.
Right.
And that is, from our point of view, the only auspicious realm. So in terms of the state of mind, involves success and failure, and gain and loss, and navigating towards, more possibility for compassion and for insight to dawn, because you're not winning or losing all the time.
Right. Well, I was just reading this thing last night, because I hang out on the weird message boards and, I'm following the UFO stuff, probably in an unhealthy fixation. But one of the threads in the UFO conversation, with all the stuff coming out and the disclosure and who knows, is it real, is it not real, is that aliens, or whatever these things are, they don't even call them aliens anymore. They're calling them non-human intelligence, view human beings as vessels that contain souls within them and that these souls are being, like, I don't know how to put it, it's like wine. So they're sort of, they keep humans coming back over and over again to sort of like sweeten or to like, I don't know, ferment or whatever you want to call it, to mm-hmm. create a really mm-hmm. great vintage soul, which mm-hmm. they eat. And so
that's like that Twilight Zone, remember? To Serve Man, it was a cookbook.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't remember. That might have been
before. Yeah. I do remember it. I remember, funny. They find some book. They think there's, but yeah, so, which plays in, which obviously connects to this Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist cosmology in which the idea is you don't, it's a trap. Like, no matter what, it's a trap. If you are mm-hmm. coming back here over and over and over again, right? It's a, mm-hmm. you're, mm-hmm. it's a trap. Don't do it anymore. There is a way to step mm-hmm. out of all the realms, right? And that's why the human birth is the great birth, because that is your odds increase exponentially if your mm-hmm. mission is to no longer keep landing in this samsaric loop of
except there's
heaven
fine
to hell.
Print in the, there's fine print in the contract, which is even
What's
if you
that?
Did escape, you have to come back as a bodhisattva and as a compassionate person. So
is
you
that
don't
always
really get,
the case, or you do
no,
have to come back, or can you just skip it?
No, you could go. You could skip it. According to the teachings, the doctrine, you could skip it and, you know, either go to a pure realm, you know, a higher kind of quality of lifestyle in terms of what all the virtues we're talking about, or just, you know, kind of merge with the spaciousness of the situation and not really need to identify yourself or create a unique personal identity. But you would, according to like the Mahayana teachings and further on, you would say, well, I think I am going to create a unique identity with a beard and a hat and some headphones and a family so that I can help other people who are in this in samsara. So
now,
if you read the fine print in the contracts I got you, there is no way out, literally. So
now,
if you read the fine print in the contracts I got you, there is no way out, literally.
So, you know, I think maybe you should talk a little bit about the, you know, the initial reaction people have to any of this. At least the reaction I had it when you start hearing this stuff is like, my God, that sounds sort of, I like my life. I want to be a human. What do you mean you don't want to keep coming back? Or you know, people will misconstrue reincarnation as a kind of lazy way of dealing with annihilation when you die. People will think, oh yeah, they believe in reincarnation because they're afraid of death, but they don't realize that the Buddhists are saying, no, you don't want to reincarnate. Like, that's not a good thing necessarily that you keep coming back. That's not good. We got to get out of this thing. It's a loop. Talk about death spiral. It's a fucking death spiral, man. And you got to get out of that. So can you talk about that a little bit? Like, That you know, when people hear this stuff for the first time, it sounds almost like it's dismal, that it is you know, reducing the human experience to
it's nihilistic, negative.
Yeah.
Many, I think even I heard the Pope say that about Buddhism. You know, it's a common, let's say, critique or understanding of Buddhism. They're intellectual. They're nihilistic. They don't believe in this, they don't believe in that. So the whole thing ends up being kind of like somebody taking the plug out of a hot bath that you're trying to take at the same time. They keep pulling the plug on it, right? So, you know, it's, I think, helpful to look directly at what your experience is, which is mainly what the Buddhists say. Look directly at your experience. Is there any discomfort or not? Up to you to say. Is it? Are you in some kind of hot bath with bubbles, or is there more to it than that? And there's some kind of suffering and some kind of complexity, and some kind of ill at ease quality. So let me give you the. I love this stuff, and I probably over reiterated, you know, countless times the kinds of suffering there are, the kinds of pain.
Yes.
And you check the box first. Not getting what you want. Check or no check.
Check.
Okay. Getting what you don't want. Check or no check.
Check. I use Instacart.
Alternating between getting what you want and losing what you want. That's the third one.
Check.
And fourth, all pervasive, kind of a sense of slight out of sync quality, or, you know, lack of ease and flow that just sort of permeates, pervades, even the great moments that you have. There's a kind of slight undercurrent, underbelly of some kind of irritation or, you know, ill at ease quality. Yes? No?
Sure. Check.
Well, ba-boom. I mean, that's called the first noble truth. And if you're willing to look into that, you just shifted away from a nihilistic interpretation to a realistic interpretation. You're actually looking at your experience directly without wishful thinking and without negative thinking, without a nihilistic approach without a theistic approach. You're just looking directly at the nature of your experience. That's all we're saying.
Okay, but when I look at, mm-hmm. at those things,
yeah,
my feeling is it's worth it.
Oh,
that's the cost of suffering. If that's the admission fee to have like the experience of like watching my third child be born, to watching a marriage go from like chaos to love, to watching like,
or the other way
it's
around.
The other way around. But you know, there is like a kind of culmination that can happen in a life, where you look at all of that you just said and identify it, you know it, you're more than familiar with it, and but you're still like, but this is still quite lovely, even with all that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I don't think I think in a way that's almost like not what's being talked about. That's a different point, which is, you know, you could call that some kind of basic goodness or wholesomeness or Buddha nature or bodhicitta, you know, that the goodness is still there, you know, but our clinging to it creates further suffering. Yes, would you agree with that?
Yes. Look, you know,
it's the clinging that's being challenged. And are you equally equanimous, you know, when the good marriage goes to bad, or when you lose a child, or when you lose your job, or when there's like a flood that wipes out thousands of people in Libya? Are you still, can you hold the boat steady during those experiences? Then you're looking at something that to me is worth kind of really cultivating.
Right.
Equanimity.
Look, mm-hmm. here's my counter to it. This is a dream mm-hmm. I was going to tell you about.
Okay.
The next time we talked, I had the craziest dream. And in the dream, I was in my body, but it was like a cave-in situation. And there were beings like outside of the cave-in. I don't know how to put it other than like I experienced the totality of suffering, of like being stuck as a person, as like just this. It was the most... I've never, you know, you hear people talk, you know, everyone hears that story about like the master takes the student in a lake, shoves his head underwater, and like the student finally comes up for air. And the master's like, when you want realization the way you wanted air, that's when you started your practice. And in this dream, it was like that. It was like a full recognition of all the first noble truth stuff, like a full experience of like the price of being incarnate, the reality of it after all the fairy tale stories you've been telling yourself are stripped away. Just this compressed cave-in situation, you know. And I woke up and was like, oh god, that was fucking horrible. The experience was like a horror movie or something, and I don't know if what that was. If maybe we didn't turn the AC on that night, and I live in fucking Texas, and it just got too hot in my room or something. But it was horrifying. Like it was when I woke up and thought about it in terms of suffering and in terms of the first noble truth, that's where I was like, okay, right, this is what they're talking about. This is what is the root of any action that I take that doesn't have compassion in it or love in it or kindness in it. Of course, how are you going to act in any kind of noble, kind, sweet way if underneath all of your stories you feel like you're stuck in a mine shaft?
Couldn't, you know, that's your unconscious preaching the Dharma to your conscious mind. That's what that is. You know, like, you know, it's interesting when I talked to somebody yesterday who doesn't remember their dreams, and I thought, well, wow, what a loss, you know, because
yes,
there's so much unfiltered information in your dreams in subconscious mind, and it's talking to you, maybe symbolic language, you have to be able to translate it. But when you said that, I thought, okay, first noble truth, the four kinds of suffering, the noticing the discomfort, the anxiety that underlies, not as a proclaiming it to be a thing, but noticing that it's part of our ecosystem. That's the first.
Yeah.
Second one is looking at the cause of it, which I think is what your dream is really about. It's the second noble truth. What is causing that? And that is, you know, meant to be a serious contemplation for us. If you acknowledge the first, right, you're supposed to seriously contemplate the second one. The third one is the cessation of it. Hello, everybody who's idealistic and who's wants a, you know, to have a good dream and go to heaven. The cessation of suffering. How's that? That's not pretty. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Because you've released the causes of it, and the cause of it is clinging to a mistaken sense of personal identity. That's the cause of it. That is taken to be permanent. That's taken to be rigid. That's fixed. That's defending itself. All the things that are like basically your imagination in overdrive, creating a nightmare for yourself.
Then let's get to the fourth one, because this one, the Eightfold Path. So this Aaron with this new baby, we looked at all the mistakes we made in the last with the last two kids, and we decided, okay, we're gonna try this thing that we've heard about, and apparently some Asian cultures they do it, which is the mother gets to stay in bed for a month. Like, not literally like bedridden, but they stay in their room, you bring them food, you try to like lessen, just give them time with the baby, not stressing about any other thing, that you try to remove all the stressors from it so that they can heal, so that the baby, the milk the baby's drinking doesn't have some kind of like cortisol in it or stress chemicals. And so this time, I went into like full servant mode, like, you know, just bringing food up, making sure she had water, just, you know, just trying to, as much as I could, make that my number one focus. And my mood changed over that month. Like, it was just joy. It went from, you know, my own selfish bullshit, like, I want to play video games, loving carrying the tray up, loving getting the water, loving all of it. And then everything started shifting. And I realized, my God, I just have not really focused at all on the Eightfold Path at all. And I was thinking, this must be what they're talking about when they talk about right livelihood. This is what they're talking about. Because it's like, it's easy. You hear the first three, you know, it's so simple and it needs to be simple. Stop being attached, the suffering will end. But the fourth, it complexifies a little bit. It's like, here's how you let go. And this is a way of life. This is the way of life. And, you know, and then that, now it's like, anytime I feel like in that compressed state, 100% of the time, it's because I am fixating on myself. Because like, even if I'm helping someone, or trying to help someone, the intent is not to help. You know what I mean? The intent behind it is still self-fixation.
Even maybe more precisely, you're fixating on a false sense of self.
Yeah, right.
Because
right,
if you look at your sense of identity when you're being just a compassionate husband, there's still a sense of self, but it may be more genuine in some sense that is what actually makes you feel like you're thriving and that your life is good and that you're helping other people and being kind. You know, you have to explore the sense, because the Eightfold Path is the relational part of the path. Up to then, it's been pretty much like you're just seeing it clearly. You're seeing what it is. You're seeing what it isn't. Now, in a relational truth, which we're not trying to demolish with our practice, right? You're trying to inhabit the relational world with an enlightened perspective. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
That's really
totally.
That's different than disappearing into a puff of smoke. You're inhabiting your relational world with acuity, with accuracy, with a clear sense of what is and what isn't, and with a feeling of blending in with it and compassion and being of service. And then there's some kind of shine that happens, you know. Now maybe that is or isn't full Buddhahood, who knows? I couldn't say. But it certainly is seems right. like a part of a journey towards something that you'd feel more integrated, more wholesome, better, more balanced, and also less fixated on stupid shit. Now, maybe that is or isn't full Buddhahood, who knows? I couldn't say. But it certainly is. Seems right. like a part of a journey towards something that you'd feel more integrated, more wholesome, better, more balanced, and also less fixated on stupid shit.
Yeah, well, there is I don't know how to put it. Like when you're doing it, there is a dissipation of the self. Like you do go away, kind of. Like there is just carrying the tray up to the room, heating up the food. You know, something. But in the midst of that, I was just trying to apply the things we've worked on together to it. You know, applying the mindful state to the thing. Like just look at the tray, look at the food, focus on carrying the tray up. Focus on, you know, just that, just do that without any of the other shit. And somewhere in there, yeah, it's a glow is the best way to a shine. Something happens where, I don't know, it was revelatory. And it's so simple and obvious. I'm sorry, y'all. I'm a selfish asshole that this is even revelatory to me. But it really was. And I don't know that, and you see how the meditation practice and the ability to do that sort of thing go hand in hand, like the two work together really well.
Yeah, I that is the Eightfold Path. That's the thing is, without doing something that kind of introduces a new set of parameters, a kind of method, a way of moving gradually towards something that's more reasonable, it's very hard to make a leap across a chasm. You have to build a bridge of some kind, which is called, relative bodhicitta, to do something that's actually quite reasonable in a way, even if it seems radical compared to the selfish asshole you're talking about that we all can be at times, you know?
Right. Yeah.
You're not the only one, by the way, Duncan. You know that, right?
I've heard. I've heard there might be a few of us out there.
They're roaming. I think they're the people who are roaming around in that dream of yours.
Yes. Yes. And it's the other cool thing about it is, you know, here suddenly is like something that goes beyond just this sitting practice, something that goes beyond the mindfulness practice. Now there's an actionable, in a very simple, actionable series of things you can do around you. Because it does appear that pretty much at any time in your life, there's someone who needs you to help them, or there's some... And then I started noticing, I'd love to know what you think about this. I realized, but there is a way to serve myself. Like there is a way to serve myself in a non-selfish way. You know, like there is a way to like identify that suffering body or whatever you want to call it, not as me, but as a part of the universe or something. And then, you know, we've heard countless iterations of this very same thing, but kind of, you know, hold it like a baby. You know what I mean? So that instead of like when the baby's crying, you're not like, I want to obliterate you. I want to annihilate you. I want to like extinguish you.
And very, very demonstrably and very realistically, you are that baby.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean? I mean, we all are that baby because look at our days, how they go by. I mean, we're kind of like, we're still being toilet trained on some basic level.
Oh, I'm still being toilet
trained. I don't know if we're turning into fine wine or whatever that other premise was, but we are being trained to become more processed, more cultured, more evolved. I think that's part of living. That's a viable thing, and people go about it different ways. But without that part of living, it feels pretty aimless to me. If there's no journey, there's no sense of path. Just accumulating wealth or power does not seem to be as satisfying as that is at the end. And I see people at the end of their life, it wasn't satisfying.
You know, yeah, that's a real rough one. That's a real rough, like, you know, because you do, when you do catch a glimpse of whatever you want to call it, when you do catch a glimpse of like, wait, how is it that, you know, washing dishes that my wife just ate off of upstairs is more fulfilling than like my peak moments of hedonism? Like, how is it not fulfilling? Isn't even the right word for it. It's like discovering a new country or a new zone or something. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the encounter with that is so, I could see how at the end of your life, God, I mean, it almost would be better that you didn't realize that. It would almost be better that you just died and you're like, God damn it, I wish I had more money, than like to die and realize, like, fuck, all that time I was trying to like accrue wealth and stuff. I could have had this instead. And this is true value. Ooh, that sucks. That's a, that's not a fun.
I guess there's some version, which is part of the teachings, you know, that I studied, where you can explore the possibility of integrating those two realities, which is leadership, which is communication, which is arts, right, which is culture, which is government. All those things could be integrated with the sensibility that you just talked about. And then you have a very, very potentially resonant, rich situation. I think we've seen moments like that in various times and places. And as the kind of people we are, you're always looking, how could I plant seeds, even if they won't sprout right away? But in the future, at some point, you want to plant those kind of seeds, you know? So I think there's a lot of people I talked to that if you tapped into it, they would vote for that. They would drink to that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it does bring a question up. You know, can you work backwards? Like, in other words, instead of starting with the sort of becoming familiar with what you are, what's going on with you, all the things that go along with like some sitting practice or some contemplative practice. Instead of doing any of that bullshit, could you theoretically just start at the Eightfold Path and then work your way backwards?
Well, so that, you know, that's a great question in a way. And I think if you look at different Buddhist schools and different, you know, spiritual trainings of all kinds, they do work backwards and forwards. And sometimes, so right, you know, we talk about the view, developing the view, the practice and the outcome. So some people start with the view. I like starting with the view so there's some clarity about what's even being talked about. That's my, maybe my little bit of a bias or whatever, or style, personal style. But you could start with the practice. Like a lot of Zen doesn't really start with much of a view. You know, it's just like get on the cushion and just be with yourself. So yeah, or karma yoga, just go help people, go feed people, like, you know, like Maharaji says, go feed people, you know, help people, serve people. So I do think you could go forwards or backwards or up and down and over and across. But at some point, if there's not clarity in the view, you know, a lot of practice could potentially take you into a space in which, and I use the analogy of like learning how to play tennis, holding the racket the wrong way. You hit 1,000 balls, but you're not progressing the equation really because there's some fundamental twist in your logic, you know. So I'm sort of more process driven.
Still, Yeah, I know. I like that. Yeah. No, I agree with, I don't know because like I you know, I've been working with you for so long now. So that, and that is the sort of process that we've worked with, but I get it, you know, and I see how like, I don't, one seems like it could get really technical. The other seems like it becomes spontaneous or something. One, you know, there's suddenly in one, all these ethics and rules and regulations, restrictions, do this and that and this and then that and then that and all of that, some kind of memorization or something. Whereas the other one, it seems like from the view, all that other stuff kind of naturally, spontaneously occurs.
Yeah, and I think you're right to point out it is a two-way highway. But if you're doing it practice first, you want to make sure you have good teachers, because if they say, you know, hit the ball 1,000 times and they never show you the right way to hold the racket and they didn't know the right way to hold the racket, it's you know, possible that, you know, a lot of time and energy could go down the tube. So make sure, you know, but if you have a good teacher like who you trust and, you know, has some clear manifestation of the qualities that you're trying to cultivate, you know, they could suggest something. Like I tell people to sit a lot. And they either think that's a good idea or they don't. But at a certain point, it seems essential to me, whether you understand it or not, that you actually get your butt on the cushion and actually cut the chain of the karmic chain a little bit and just rest your mind a little bit and see what's going on under the hood. So that's pretty mechanical in a way, to tell people just to do their practice, you know?
Yeah. Have you noticed in Buddhism that in some forms of Buddhism, a Protestant ethic emerges that seems a little surprising? Like, having worked with you, it's interesting sometimes whenever I find myself on this message board or that message board, there's a lot of like stuff that doesn't seem great to me, like a lot of superstition, a lot of beating up oneself, a lot of like, is this irreverent? Is it irreverent to do this in front of the Buddha, a statue of the Buddha? Do I have my flower in the right bowl? You know, like things like, and people legitimately feeling like shit because they, I don't know, didn't hit the bell the right way or the, you know,
it's a total, you know, bell curve from always to conservative to progressive. And yes, there are in my sanghas over the years, there have been plenty of super conservative people who just relish the forms and, you know, really imbue the forms with a lot of power. And then there's people who go like, you know, totally formless. Like, so the weird thing that I would say is that the teacher that I studied with, which was Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, somehow managed to marry those two things.
Right.
It was kind of something that stunned me. So you couldn't sneak out the left or sneak out the right. You couldn't kind of get around it.
Right.
But I lean towards the formless, and his ground is clearly formless. You know. So
right.
You know what? Can I read you something that I sort of had isolated for today?
Yeah, please.
About the from Trungpa Rinpoche, who, you know, you and I both share admiration for how he sort of helps illuminate you know, the view, at least. He's talking about the fourth moment, which has intrigued me because we're going to be in our upcoming info session, we're going to talk about, you know, nowness and eternity, which is sort of an interesting, we're not going to do that today, but just a little glimpse at that. The fourth moment is this thing that I find fascinating because there's past, future, and then the present is called the third moment. So why would you need, what is a fourth moment? That's really, and what it's delineating is the fourth moment is beyond that tribunal of the past, present, and future. So it's a space, kind of, you could say. That's worth pointing out. So he says, it is unprogrammed experience, simultaneously experiencing hot and cold water in its own individuality. Whenever there's a reminder, it's part of the fourth moment. The present is the third moment. It has a sense of presence. You might say, I can feel your presence, or I can feel the presence of the light when it's turned on. Now there is no darkness. The present provides a sense of security. You know where you are, you keep your flashlight in your pocket. If you encounter darkness, you take out your flashlight and shine the light to show you where you're going. You feel enormous relief created by that little spot of light in front of you. You don't see the whole environment, but you feel the sense of presence and the present.
Yeah.
The fourth moment is a state of totality. basic awareness is taking place, which doesn't need any particular reassurance as such. It is happening. It is there. You feel the totality. You perceive not only the beam of light from the flashlight, but you see the space around you at the same time. The fourth moment is a much larger version of the third moment. Without the experience of the fourth moment, there isn't enough intelligence taking place. You're just accepting things naively, and that naivete may become the basis for spiritual materialism. Naivete is believing in something that doesn't exist, which means that it becomes a sense of ignorance or stupidity, which is where the God realm conversation we were having earlier comes in. You turn on the cold shower and you hope everything's going to be okay. You know, so this is, and then he goes on to say the fourth moment, your experience of your life is actually the fourth moment, of including the suffering, including everything. And it is happening now without any real ability to say, be here now or don't be here now. It's already happening. Somebody turned the switch on a long time ago, and you're having your experience as it is. So it means paying attention to the totality of both the good and bad, happy and sad, you know, kind of quality of the whole thing. So it means paying attention to the totality of both the good and bad, happy and sad, you know, kind of quality of the whole thing.
I really
love. Does that
love,
make any sense?
Oh, yeah. I love that he like kind of points out almost like a blindfold quality of the present moment that you, it's cool. It's because I know what he's talking about because, and I think that what, at least for me, what does happen is you do the you go from this like neurotic fixation on the future or the past or what you have coming. I used to have horrific, God, there's a name for it. It's anxiety related to something. So if I like, you know, I have a show tonight and I, right. And it used to be that if I had a show at night, that's all I would think about. I would feel so anxious through the whole day. And all I would be thinking about is like, shit, I got to do this show. Oh my God. Am I going to get enough rest? I got to write jokes. And then that would sort of create like a line through every frame of everything. And I thought that was normal. I thought it was normal. And that's a shitty way to live if you're a comedian, because hopefully you have shows every night or as many nights as you can. And so then you start practicing and you discover that what he's talking about, the present moment. Now, all of a sudden, at least for me, I started having these little moments of like not being worried, because I'd figured out how to get into the moment. And then I would come out of it and feel guilty. Like, Jesus, that seems like you're not supposed to be able to do that. Like, that's like taking a vacation, an unauthorized vacation or something.
Right.
And then some familiarity with how to do that. And then more and more in the moment, the anxiety diminishes. Until now, I have a little bit fleeting moments like that, but it's nothing like what it used to be. But then you start realizing, shit. Like, I don't think this is it. Like, I don't think this is it. And then there, this like weird, the present moment starts feeling like a screen or something. You know, a screen or
a gauzy filter.
Yes, a gauzy filter. Mm-hmm. And you realize, fuck, I was thinking that this is emptiness, or this is when they're talking about emptiness. This must be what they mean. But you realize, no, it's still not that. And then that's when you start catching, I think, glimpses of what he's talking about, which is this sort of primordial awareness that is saturated into the present moment, but is not being impacted.
And it's indestructible, and it's indestructible and unfabricated. It doesn't depend on you recognizing it at all. You're already part of it. And here's the irony, Duncan. As when we were talking about that a minute ago, I'm sitting here thinking, I mean, you know, you can't control when somebody else is talking, you go like, I'm following your line of thought, but another line of thought developed. And in this case, it was the irony of everything you're talking about. The whole thing is to try to make people laugh. That I found really funny. You're going through all that just to make people laugh.
Look, I know I'm different. Most comedians, incredibly balanced and a very healthy relationship with their job and life.
And their childhood, right?
Their childhood. Oh, I'm an exception. I don't know what it is. But yeah. But you know, that it's sort of like, and when I first started encountering that and then trying to differentiate it or something from the present moment, I realized, like, for me in the present moment, what really grabs me is the visual field. Like, I get really locked into colors and stuff, mm-hmm. you know, like the visual, the way my body feels, not so much hearing, not so much, but something about the spatiality of the present moment is hard to see beyond, and almost like you don't want to try to see beyond. You don't want to like try to like think, is there something on the other side of this wall or whatever this is that people call the present moment? Is there,
well, there's a
is
near,
there something
there's
else?
A near field, but not exactly spot on version of it, which is called jhana states. We've talked about that before, jhana. You become absorbed in the present. It's like a little bit like trippy, you know, and I've been going out since the pandemic. I've been on the road for a month now, and I feel like I am on some kind of trip because everything's super vivid compared to the 2D world I've been living in for 3 years.
Yeah, right. You know,
but it's heightened. It's very heightened. So that's okay as long as that, you know, as long as that doesn't become yet another in a long string of attempts to amuse oneself.
Well, how do you not at first amuse yourself with it, David? I mean, how do you not when all of a sudden the encounter with the present moment that you used to have to take 100 micrograms of LSD to encounter suddenly starts happening minus the acid? Like, how are you not going to like, you know, I get it. Because, you know, that's another thing that happens is suddenly you aren't like, you are in your body. I'm not saying I'm astrally projecting or any bullshit like that, but it's like your horizon widens and you're now the rest of stuff thing starts going away. And now you're just sort of like in this tapestry or something. And that is a blast. Like, that is a blast. And honestly, I get it. I get it. I could see why you would get completely addicted to that. And for me, also something unnerving about the encounter with that other thing.
Do you agree though that any attachment? Would you say that any attachment to any type of experience will create a further ripple going forward? In other words,
absolutely.
you're going to want to get back there somehow or other if there's something about it that. So, you know, I've said this before. Rinpoche used to say, just disown it. Disown it. There's nothing in to own.
And it's
a little bit aggressive. It's not like letting go. He said, disown it so that you clearly recognize our ability to get sort of caught up and fixated at the drop of a hat. And so you cut it. Proactively, but having
let me
said
tell
that,
you, I'm addicted to vaping. You think I'm going to be able to let go of being able to suddenly like shift into some unitive state with the present moment? Like, that's where it does get brutal. That's where choking Trump does get brutal because it's like, I don't want, no. Like, this is a wonderful little outpost here. This is wonderful. I don't have to freak out about my shows. I don't have to worry about all the shit on my plate anymore. I can just go into the moment and it's not like it seems to be amplifying my ability to do stuff. Like, I'm better at doing things when I'm in that state. It's flow state is what people call this. It's the flow state is what people call it.
Well, you can help me here, Duncan. You can help me out here, okay? Give you a chance to be compassionate to me, okay? You're my guide to the zeitgeist at the moment, along with other folks.
Oh, no.
But, you know, my wheel has turned, you know what I mean? I'm like grandfather, and I'm going like, it looks a lot like, you know, I'm going to Bhakti Fest, which feels like a Grateful Dead concert to me, but that's just because I know what that is, you know, energetically.
I know what that is.
So if you are vaping, I was in London teaching a workshop at a beautiful yoga studio there just this weekend, and I saw people in cafes vaping, and I'm going to admit, I don't know what it is. What is vaping? What are you vaping? What's in the cocktail?
Okay, so like if you want to look at like, let's compare like addiction or mechanisms of addiction to electricity. So cigarettes, as far as addiction go, I think we could say this is the light bulb. When someone figured out you could roll tobacco up and burn it and inhale it and get weirdly high and focused and, you know, and then just keep doing that over and over again until you've coughed your lungs out or whatever. That's great. Cigarettes taste like shit and they make you stink. So in some infernal laboratory in my fantasy, somewhere in the hollow earth, an imp, demon, arch demon, maybe, was like, okay, how can we add sugar to nicotine? How can we make nicotine sweet? Now let's add to the experience of one of the most, if not the most addictive substance on the planet, another addictive substance. And then now you have the vape. Now you have vaping, which is these.
So you're inhaling nicotine? Is that what's going on?
You're inhaling some kind of nicotine that is being converted into a vapor that is also has within it some sweetener. And so as you're breathing it in, you're not tasting the shit cigarette taste. And it's sad because in California, you can't, they won't let you have flavored vapes. But, and then, you know, honestly, I get it. Cause like kids are smoking these fucking things. In California, you can buy nicotine flavored or tobacco flavored vapes, which I would rather have a trucker fart in my mouth than breathe in one of those.
Oh, that's
things.
Nice. Disgusting. That's a good image. So is that what's in
I'll
your right hand?
Join
now?
My
in,
OnlyFans.
In that purple? Is that in your hand right now? That purple?
You have to charge these monstrous things. And So.
Okay, you know what? I want to make a date with. Can I make a date with you for real time interaction?
Yes.
You're going to vape, we'll sit and you vape, and you'll just describe to me what's happening moment by moment.
Okay, I'd love to.
What's actually happening. And,
that's
and, you know,
great.
Do your real, bring your real mindfulness to apply to the process, because there's a lot of substances that will jump you up a notch. And I personally feel like the tradition I come from has a couple of traditions have some really good, like, methods or techniques to jumpstart the engine a little. And one is called Wind Horse, which is... I'm starting to talk about Wind Horse a lot more, which is something that Trungpa Rinpoche taught about. In other words, there's some way of channeling your natural energy by mixing intentionality, a kind of sense of acute awareness, and understanding how the mind-body configuration works, where I think you can get effects that would be less addictive and more compelling. So I don't mean to go on to the internet here and say, I got something better than vaping for the kids
I
out there.
I believe you.
But I'm not sure that's not true. And the other is
chi energy, build up the prana.
Oh, man.
No, we're getting some body work for me soon. I'm thinking about going to a hypnotist. Like I made a vow to Aaron that I would stop this when the baby came, and I'm still fucking doing it like a complete rat in a cage. So it's like, again, to go back to the realms, this is for me, like how I really understand the realms is through addiction. Like addiction teaches you about the God realm, realm of the jealous gods. Cause the cycle of getting, high on whatever it is you're getting high on.
Sure.
It follows the same thing. You know, you have one drink, realm of the gods. Two drinks, three drinks. Literally, you're going to be in the realm of the jealous gods. You know, like, wait, who's texting you?
Realm.
What was that? Right. And then as you start coming down, now we're in the hell realms. You're just losing.
No, you skipped the main realm of the hungry ghost. That's the main addiction realm.
Yeah, the hungry ghost. And then like, so you, the cycle of addiction, you like sobriety, human realm. And then you're like, fuck this. I don't want to be in the human realm. I don't care if there's something auspicious about this bullshit. Where's my vape? and then you repeat this rotten cycle. I mean, I get it. Like, I think, that is like.
And then the trucker really is farting in your mouth at that point.
At this point, yeah, I think it's safe to say. I mean, I wouldn't know. This could be farts. This could be Chinese farts. All the vapes come from China. I don't know what there's in here. It could be Chinese kids farting in these fucking things, like eating cotton candy and farting in these things. I don't know. But if I knew, I'd probably still do it. Like, even if they're like, you do understand what you're inhaling, they shove a bunch of nicotine and cotton candy in factory workers' assholes, and they just fart into these things. And I would be like, okay, well, I'll take one, two, I guess. I'll quit soon.
Well, it is, of what you said, you know how much I care about you and your family and as a friend. What I hear you saying is this is not really truly satisfying. You know, at the beginning you present it as if it was, but, you know, Aaron doesn't want you to do it. You don't really feel good about it. So then that's a different thing. That's called renunciation at that point. You're no longer delusional. You're just habituated. That's two different things.
Oh, that's cool. All right. Well, I'm habituated. Yeah, I can't wait to, you know, I'm telling you, if this thing works, David, you could do a whole weekend for those of us who have gotten trapped by these fart machines. Like, you could do a whole weekend of, like, helping people quit vaping. And it would be massively popular if it works. And I will let people know if this works or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I certainly don't. Wouldn't be happy to be put in the position of like, oh, here's that Buddhist teacher who figured out how to overcome addiction. You know, in some sense, all six realms are based on some form of addiction. It's just what you said earlier. There's a sense of duality. I'm here. It's there. I need that to feel better. So I fixated on it one way or another. Even people in hell are addicted to the hellishness of it.
But let's talk about the fourth moment for 1 second.
Yeah.
You can still reacquaint yourself with that place and simultaneously be addicted to something, right? Like, you could be in the fourth moment and vape simultaneously. It's not like one precludes the other. If we're talking about some indestructible, primordial awareness reality, it doesn't seem to care what's going on within it in the way that we care. You know, it's not impacted one way or the other by whatever the particular ripples in time space are, or am I misunderstanding it?
Well, you know, again, first thought when you're talking about that, the universe, you know, if there was such a kind of sense of totality about it, that wasn't dominated by our individual perspective to try to create a smaller universe, a Duncanverse or a Nungiverse or whatever, the universe does not care. I think I would go on record as saying the universe literally doesn't care at the level of that you're talking about. However, just like you going through all those conniptions to make other people laugh, which made me laugh just thinking about how hard you're working to make other people laugh and how kind of basically fun, how funny you are, even when you're not trying. It's really, you're really funny, you know, is the universe also there's a cosmic joke going on, which is in its not caring. It's also working really hard, it seems, to pretend that it does.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. I mean, I see how one leads the other. I get it. I mean, I do get it. Like, glimpses I've caught of it, I understand why the rotten emphasis on meditation. I understand why that, because otherwise you're going to be sort of faking it, which I think is better than not. Any attempt at being kind to people around you, even if the thing behind it is just absurdly confused and neurotic, is better than not, I think. Maybe that's wrong. I don't know. But then if you start getting the little glimpses that you get of it and can avoid being addicted to those glimpses and then all the stuff that goes along with that, which you and I have both experienced, or which you've definitely heard me talk about, because then you just want to go back and then you're not getting back there, so you feel like you're failing and what the fuck is this or why wouldn't it have been better to not see it at all,
right?
But somewhere in there, suddenly, like, you do start recognizing that that is real. The fourth moment is real.
It's pervasive.
Yeah, pervasive. And then you start recognizing how that is a relief unlike anything you've ever experienced. And then other people who haven't encountered that, that's all they're looking for. And so then I could see how that just leads to a kind of spontaneous kindness, or gives you the ability to have a little more patience with people around you than you than you would otherwise. Because if you're in a nightmare, you're going to act like you're in a nightmare.
Well, and the fourth moment is a very refined way of saying, don't get caught up in the first moment, the past. And that makes total sense to everybody. If you're obsessing with the past and what you did wrong and stuff, don't get caught up in the second moment, which is the future, which is just anxiety about what hasn't even happened yet. And don't even get caught up in the third moment, which is the notion of presence. So there is a kind of quality of recognizing and letting go that is the practice associated with that. There's a lot of letting go of which could look, if it's misinterpreted, could look like carelessness or laziness.
You sure?
That could be the sort of not exactly right version of letting go properly. But it could, and that's why they would say carefree rather than careless, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, this is something you told me a long time ago, just sort of a shifting of identification. You know, that you're sort of, it's just a simple shift. Whenever you have told me that in the past, it's always just been like, yeah, okay, simple, right? But I get it, because, you know, the more you are encountering that space or identifying with that space, then the less you're going to have the normal worries you had before. I mean, you know, like how much of a person's life is plagued by the fear of death, David? You know, how much of my life was just plagued by the fear of death? Plagued by the what will happen when I drop this body, plagued by that, you know, in a not healthy way, not a Buddhist sense of like, yeah, you're going to die. So let's start dying now. Let's start getting into that. Let's start working with that. But just like, I don't want to fucking die. I don't want to breathe, exhale for the last time. And but then you start encountering that thing, and there seems to be a I'm not saying I'm not afraid of death. I don't want to fucking die, but the neurotic terror of death starts diminishing. The temperature goes down on it, you know, because there's that play, whatever you want to call it, the fourth moment. And then whatever that is definitely feels to me compassionate. It doesn't feel like, I know what you're saying. Like there isn't, I don't encounter neutrality there. And maybe that's just because I'm still stuck in myself or something, and I'm not neutral. But I don't know. It doesn't strike me as like some ambivalent Vulcan or something.
No, they say it has a luminosity and a warmth to it.
Yeah, warmth.
Even its most expansive, you know, kind of unconditional quality still has some texture of luminosity, clarity, vividness, warmth, compassion. All those things are kind of part of the fabric of the unconditioned mind. So therefore, if you can find a way to relax a little bit, once you have your basic discipline in place, mixing in a sense of relaxation with that discipline can be really effective, you know. And a lot of people are used to just trying too hard, right? You know, just pushing hard and then being disappointed or self-critical.
Yeah, and if you're trying too hard in one place, you're trying too hard in every place, probably. But you know what? Here's a good thing to wrap up on before we talk about your... what's coming up, and it sounds amazing, actually. This particular one sounds like a wonderful, wonderful... I think I might want to sign up for this one that you're doing. But this...
That'd be great. You already took the level one, okay. You know that, right?
What's that?
You already took the first level of it and part of the second one.
Oh, I did?
Yeah. Well, go ahead. Anyhow, proceed.
Box of Rain, my favorite Grateful Dead song. Reminds me of what we're talking about. And, you know, this was written, I can't remember who wrote this. Which of them wrote this? Phil Lesh, Robert Hunter, and I think he wrote it for one of his parents that was passing away. Do you know the lyrics to this?
No, not offhand.
Okay, it goes, I'm not going to read the whole song, but it goes... What do you want me to do for you, to see you through? A box of rain will ease the pain, and love will see you through. Just a box of rain, wind, and water. Believe it if you need it. If you don't, just pass it on. Sun and shower, wind and rain, in and out the window like a moth before a flame. And it's just a box of rain. I don't know who put it there. Believe it if you need it, or leave it if you dare.
Yeah. You know, that's like a doha. At some point, you know, just you have to use poetry to point to some of these kind of things, because otherwise it just becomes too literal and, you know, graspy. That's all these great siddhas and yogis, that's what they do. They sing or they write poetry. So that's a good practice. And you are so how are your shows going? Are you being funny? Are people laughing?
Yes. Thank God. Yes. Yes. They've been great. Yeah, they've been great. Just went out on the road for the first time in a couple of months because of the baby, and it was wonderful. It was so fun. It was such a fun weekend. The audiences were fantastic, but very high. Very high. I'm not going to scold anybody, but I mean, come on, guys. I don't want the manager. I don't want to walk out and see the manager mopping your puke up. You know what I mean? Like, I appreciate that you want to be in an expanded state when you come to see my shows, but come on, man, they got to clean up your puke. Don't do that. Don't do that. But it was great. I mean, these were my favorite crowds. Maybe ever. Like, they were so fun and riotous and chaotic, and it was just a joy, man. It was so fun.
Cool.
David, tell everybody how they can sign up.
Well, thank you for that opportunity, and always you're so supportive and helpful. We're you know, our platform is called dharmamoon.com for the folks who haven't experienced it yet. Dharma, moon, the usual way, .com. And our sort of centerpiece has been this mindfulness meditation teacher training program, 100-hour program. And it's usually over 4 months. We have one starting October 13th. Before that, we have an info session with you and me on September 26th, which is going to be just a brief look. We're going to talk about eternity and nowness, so we can sort of wrap around the conversation about the fourth moment in there. But also then we're going to share with people what the program looks like more precisely. And we'll also have a link to it on your page with the podcast when it comes out. So in a nutshell, you know, that was going to be the title of my autobiography, Duncan, My Life in a Nutshell. What do you think? Is it okay? You know, so in a nutshell, which is where I like to get things to fit into a nutshell, it's a way to stabilize, learn about the practice of mindfulness meditation, which everybody's sort of, you know, doing one way or another, try to get real clarity about the practice itself, stabilize it for yourself, for your own benefit, and then learn how to present it cohesively to others, either professionally, semi-professionally, or just like at Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
The practice stands out as a kind of foundation for all the things we're talking about. They say no mud, no lotus. I would say no mindfulness, no lotus. You know, there has to be some foundation of us willing to be present, and there's a good way to go about it. So I would just invite people, if they're interested, to come to the info session on September 26th and sign up for that. And you don't have to be there for that. If you sign up, we'll send you the recording of it. So if you can't make it in real time. And then if you want to take the leap and join us, there have been so many what I call dunkites, you know, the kind of I mean it in the lovingest and most playful way possible, Duncan. There are people who just really resonate with your perspective.
It's called the family, David. They're not Dunkites. They're family members.
Oh, okay. Okay. The members of the family of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour group. There's been so many filtering through that I feel like we've had a baby together a little bit. I know you have three babies with Aaron, but you have one with me, which is this teacher training program. Okay,
yes.
Great. All right. Well, we have to check with Aaron first and make sure it's okay. But
she's fine with it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, just that it's worked out well for the people who are, you know, in tune with the kind of conversations we've been having to check this out and come visit with us and contemplate taking this program if they're interested.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
all of the
that's
links.
What's coming up.
The links you need to sign up are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. Again, it's Dharma Moon. Check them out. It's an incredible. You guys have so many great offerings, and I love being associated with you at all. Am I the mama or the papa?
Well, you're the papa in this case, I think also, because I have to stay there and take care of the baby. You come in and, you know, kind of have a nice little visit. But I've been changing the diapers.
Yes, you're doing a great job. I'm going to bring you a tray of delicious food and bone broth. Don't worry. Okay.
Thank
you so much, David. Always a joy to chat with you.
Thanks, Duncan. See you soon.
That was David Nickturn, everybody. All the links you need to sign up for our conversation, to sign up for the teacher training program, are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. A big thank you to our sponsors, and thank you for listening. I'm going to be at the Tacoma Comedy Club next week. If you're listening to this on the week of the 18th, come and see me Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Go to TacomaComedyClub.com for tickets. After that, I'm going to be at Cobb's in San Francisco. I really hope I see y'all out there. I love you, and I'll see you next week. Hare Krishna.